I'll call the meeting to order. And first is the approval of the minutes. And Representative Anzalk has read those and saw that his name was spelled correctly, so he moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes. And today, and we're going to have help tomorrow. Our plan for the week is to hear today a part of the DHS budget proposals, and also that will continue on Wednesday, and we hope to get done with the Department of Health also on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we're going to have public testimony on the governor's proposal. And they should call, anybody who wants to testify should call Jan. And she will be holding a time clock when they testify. With that, welcome to the committee, Ms. Rankin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Human Services. I'm the budget director. And I am going to be the lead-off batter on the DHS governor's budget recommendations. A few orienting comments. You received a packet of budget pages from DHS.
Ms. Rankin, could you get that microphone a little closer?
Is that better?
Oh, that's better.
Okay. The packet that you received of our budget page materials is organized in seven different sections, and they are, each section is paginated within itself. So the page numbering starts over again at every new section, and the sections are divided with a blue page. We did that because it was faster for us to put the document together and get it over to you. The other thing that I wanted to mention to you about the document, if you haven't noticed already, the budget numbers at the top of every page, they are sometimes kind of a small font, but the detail is all there that you're used to seeing on the spreadsheet. And again, we did that for our production purposes so that we could cut and paste from the spreadsheet into the document and get the document in your hands more quickly. What I am going to talk to is in the department-wide section. It's the sixth section back. It's the next-to-last section. And page one in that section, the title of the recommendation is Operating Budget Reduction and Major Systems Operating Reduction. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what you see here is a recommendation for a permanent reduction to DHS central office operating budgets by 3% of our as yet unspent funds in the current fiscal year and 3% of budgeted funds in fiscal 11. And then it's a permanent reduction, so that reduction level carries forward into the tails. These are, because of the way DHS budgets, we receive a significant amount of federal reimbursement for our administrative costs, as you know. And what that means for an operating budget reduction is that it is, to our agency, a 3% net reduction to provide 3% to the general fund. It's an effective 5% reduction at the agency of our general fund and our healthcare access fund operating dollars. So that's what you have here on the page. We also, this year, unlike perhaps years past with operating reductions, following the directions from MMB, we looked at other funds besides our typical general fund, healthcare access fund, and TANF. So you see some special revenue fund accounts, and you see lottery funds. That is a funding source used in the chemical and mental health area. And in the case of the special revenue funds, the reductions are not permanent. They are one-time reductions. And basically, the accounting mechanism there is we are reducing expenditures, and then those dollars will be transferred to the general fund out of these special revenue accounts. And primarily, the resources that we're tapping there are one-time balances of unspent funds.
Mr. Rankin, if you could just clarify for me, I got something, I think, at the end of last week that the state had been awarded over a three-year period, I think, $130 million of grant money, and about half of it is to DHS or Department of Health. How does that show up on here, or doesn't it? If it's a grant, you're required to do certain things in there.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm guessing that that was a health care grant. I'm looking from the dollar amount, I'm guessing it was a recent award.
It was a large number,
yes,
of grants from the feds to do a variety of things.
Over several years?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Chair and members, those kinds of funds would not be something that we could necessarily tap for an operating budget reduction. Those are typically segregated and put in a special revenue account and have different kind of rules applied to them. First and foremost, we would need to make sure that we are following the requirements of the grant agreement with the feds.
Well,
so those aren't typically the kinds of dollars that you see on this page.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I know that we have a lot of pages to go through, so if there are no questions, I'll turn over to Dr. Sulik to walk through the chemical and mental health area.
Before we get there, the governor has included the $387 million in FMAP. You know, we don't know that that money's going to be there yet. Congress has not passed it. It's only on the House side. There's been no, it's never showed up on the Senate side as of yet. But yet we have this in our budget.
Mr. Chair and members, what I can say about that is that the $387.5 million, although on that initial report that MMB issued when the governor made his budget recommendations, it's listed under Department of Human Services because we have the MA program at the agency, and so that money will flow through us. But that is not an element that has been worked through our budget pages, so that our pages, when you get to the healthcare folks and you're walking through the MA reductions, none of those pages with the savings calculated are recognizing that enhanced FMAP at this point. We're in discussions with MMB. As you know, partly it's a timing of we don't know when this money will be realized and when we would show it as affecting each of our budget pages. From experience, I would say that when it is realized, then DHS will go back through and recalculate budget pages to show the correct numbers. My understanding is that the $387.5 million that's in the governor's budget recommendation has already, at a global level, that has already been discounted to account for the fact that there would be lower savings in these budget recommendations that you will see, because there's going to be 6 months more where the state FMAP share is not the 50% that used to be our standard rate, but it's down at the 39% rate where we're sitting right now because we're in the stimulus period.
And Ms. Rankin, the stimulus on FMAP was supposed to end on January 1 of next year.
Correct.
And were there things in the previous budget that would have changed starting January 1, where we, because according to stimulus, as it was written last year, we couldn't make any changes in eligibility. Did the governor's budget have changes in eligibility after that time?
Mr. Chair and members, you are correct. We did have some proposals that were enacted last year that were where the effective date was set specifically to be outside of the stimulus period because we were changing income-related eligibility, and that would violate the current stimulus requirements that we are under. There are, in the budget document for the new proposals, we have anticipated that question, and the pages that would have been affected if this enhanced FMAP is continued, the effective date's been adjusted to put it outside of the new extended six-month period. The other thing we did is on with that $387 million round number, that did already account for a few of the proposals that we knew of from last year that would not be able to go forward. The one I'm thinking of in particular is the nursing facility level of care proposal. We know that that would need to wait until, assuming there continued to be maintenance of eligibility requirements for this next six-month period, that proposal needs to wait until that restriction's lifted before it can go forward. And that particular item has already been accounted for within the 387. We are working with the MMB to go back through the rest of last year's budget proposals, and there will likely be a few more situations where we will have to make an adjustment because something that we passed last year now would need to be delayed another 6 months.
And Ms. Rankin, you're going to point those out to us, I assume, or somebody will when we go through these?
Yes, Mr. Chair, through the budget pages, and as we get information about the proposals from last year, we'll get that information to you and the committee members as well.
Okay, and next, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 387 is kind of a, it sounds like it's not part of, you're saying it's not part of the DHS budget work here. It's kind of a separate set of money in the budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes, at this point in the process, it's similar to what MMB did last year with the governor's budget, where he recognized a certain amount of stimulus as a separate standalone item in his budget, and we did not have that worked through our budget pages that we brought to you last January.
And Mr. Chair, so is it anticipated when, if that federal money comes in, that it'll be used to mitigate some of the cuts that you're proposing here, or is that going to be, are there going to be different cuts you're going to make in Health and Human Services? I mean, because that money will only pay into Health and Human Services, right?
Mr. Right. Chair and Representative Thiessen, the way that the budget works with the MA money, I think that it would become a resource and part of the broader budget discussion for the entire state budget, because the MA reimbursement, because it's a forecasted program, you've given us authority in statute to receive and spend the money as it comes in, and then we have this periodic adjustment with every forecast in November and again in February. And so when this $387.5 million comes in, it will hit the state's accounting system, and if MMB does a new fund balance, the deficit will be reduced by $387.5 million. And then it will become a discussion for you as legislators, and I'm sure the governor will have recommendations of what to do with the changed resources. But it's not something I would say that's automatically would be controlled by this agency, this particular funding committee.
Okay, that's I think I wanted to.
And before we proceed, people look around, you're going to see a lot of red shirts. And today is Nurses Day on the Hill, and we have all kinds of people here. I had about 10 in my office half an hour ago, and they're here to let us know what nurses think about the budget and other matters. So welcome to the committee. And Ms. Rankin, you can continue.
Mr. Chair and members, then before I finish up, the last thing I wanted to do is you have a one-page handout in your packet, on top of your packet perhaps. It's entitled Medical Assistance Program Growth by Segment. And this sheet is prepared as an initial response to a request that you made last week, I think it was, when the commissioner was here to give you an overview of the budget recommendations. And Chair Huntley asked a question about areas of the DHS budget that are growing fast. And what we have prepared, this was George Hoffman in Reports and Forecasts, went through the MA accounts, which of course are the largest accounts at the agency. And you can see we picked the period from 2006 through the current biennium, just so that you get four actual years and then 2 years of projected information. And the first table, the first third of the document shows you that for the part of MA that is providing continuing care services, so this is nursing facilities, but it's also waivers for elderly and disabled and home care, PCA is also in here, that the average annual increase in spending in that area of MA over these 6 years averages to 6% increase. The middle part of the table then shows you for elderly and disabled. This is for the medical care that is not provided in a continuing care setting, and it's not home care. So it's what we call at DHS the basic care. That average annual rate of growth is 7%. And then down at the bottom, you see the other segment of the MA program, which is the families and children. That is there. You've got two numbers. The spending increase on the left-hand side is an average annual increase of 12%, and the enrollment increase is an average annual 6%. Now, these are very high-level calculations, and what we've asked the other DHS presenters to do as they're going through the budget pages is to point out to you cases where there's been a reason for high growth or a policy change sometimes that has impacted otherwise the underlying growth. But what Mr. Hoffman told me, and he could not be here today, but he told me that basically what he sees in the MA program over the years is that for the families and children, the growth there is split pretty evenly. It's half because of enrollment growth and half because of the cost of the services that the folks are using is increasing as well. In the other two segments where it's for the elderly and disabled populations, Mr. Hoffman said it was more like one-third of that increase that you're seeing is because of enrollment increases, and two-thirds is because of cost and utilization. So this is an initial backdrop for you, and if you've got more specific questions and directions for us as far as the time period you want to look at and more specific information to drill down in this area, we'd be happy to take that direction back and get you more information.
And Ms. Rankin, in the table D, this is apart from what you just said, but the clawback, is that where we just got $81 million from the feds? Is that going to be in your budget already?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, I understand from Mr. Hoffman that that will be adjusted in the February forecast.
Okay, so it's not in here yet.
No, you're right, because this is the November forecast, but it will be in the once the February forecast comes out and we redo the budget, it will be in there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Just to clarify that last box, those the 12%, the 6%, those aren't additive. Those are 6% is reflected in the 12%.
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen.
And Ms. Rankin, on the last box there again, there's some rather significant increases in enrollment. And is that primarily due to the economy? I know Mr. Hoffman should answer that. But.
Mr. Chair, that was exactly going to be my reply. I think okay. Mr. Hoffman would be the best person to respond to that question. But I think that the economy is playing into it, yes. I think I remember him saying that.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to kind of ask a question before we back a little ways when we were talking about sort of the general situation that we're in here, and maybe it's still an okay time to do that since we haven't gotten into the specifics yet of the governor's budget proposal here today. But, you know, I just wanted to say, Ms. Rankin, first of all, I know this isn't any of your doing, so, you know, I don't want to shoot the messenger here. But, you know, I just find this really puzzling. I mean, I'm sitting here, and I'm sure the audience finds it a little bit puzzling, too, to follow this and understand kind of what we're really dealing with here. Because, you know, here in this budget committee, we are going to be looking very specifically at all these line items that are proposed to be cut. And we have to, you know, obviously are going to need to come up with cuts to our Health and Human Services budget. And, you know, here the governor's budget proposal includes this $387.5 million in money that he hopes will come from the federal government from a program that he, in fact, opposes and says he doesn't believe in. And then his budget proposal just pretends that it's there. And, I mean, please correct me if, you know, if I'm wrong, because I'm trying to sit here and sort of struggle with what we're really doing here. What is our task? Because we have a budget proposal in front of us that assumes that this money is there or uses it as some kind of a placeholder. So all the work that your agency has done is kind of, as I understood the previous discussion, kind of dances around this money because it's neither included in the way that it would if it was real money and came in through this program that he's hoping it would impact our budget in certain very specific ways, or it could, because it's Medicaid money and so on. But we're not counting it that way. At the same time, we're not making the real cuts that we'd have to make if it isn't in the budget. So we're sort of having it both ways in the budget proposal, it seems to me. I'm just really having trouble getting my mind around this, what we're doing here, because we're going to spend an awful lot of time. And as you know, I mean, I've had a real busy day today already, grappling with lots of different topics. And we're going to sit and go through this budget document, and we're not even dealing with real numbers. And frankly, I'm wondering what the heck I'm doing that for. I hope that, I mean, it's always good to understand, you know, these various programs and stuff, and I always appreciate the sort of explanations we get. And I don't mean to, as I say, I'm not trying to shoot the messenger at all. I know you folks work very hard to carry out the mission you're given. But I find this an exercise in frustration. I almost wonder why we're going to go through these items when they're not really the real numbers. Can you, am I understanding sort of the situation we're in terms of this $387.5 million?
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ebling, what I can say in response is that the department's budget contains the reductions that you see and you will hear about. And when this additional federal money comes into the state, it will not, my expectation is that it will not really change the budget reductions that you have in front of you, as far as it won't cause us to take this book and put it in the recycling bin and develop a new set of recommendations. What it will cause us to do is for the MA program, because there will be a different calculation of state share, we will have to go back and what we call reprice our budget pages to reflect the new lower state share. As for the larger question of what you do with a budget that is not directly addressing the $387 million, I really can't speak to that, because, as I expressed earlier, I don't view that $387 million as coming to this, my agency, for us to decide what to do with it. It because of how the accounting works and because of how you all have set up the process for how you make the budget decisions, that will get worked into your larger calculations of what your proposal is going to be to address our budget issues.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we want to get on with the presentation too, but I thought it might be useful to remind the committee that what we're going through is the governor's proposal. So in response to what Representative Liebling was saying, it is just that, it is a proposal. It still falls to the legislature, certainly to our share of the work, to come up with these cuts. They're going to be difficult, no doubt about it. But we have the job, and if we have better ideas for how to deploy the resources, limited resources, and balance the budget, then we should be coming up with them. I for one, will be interested in hearing how the governor's budget proposal goes, but I don't anticipate that we're going to agree on every single element of that proposal, and in the end, we're still going to have to balance the budget. So I don't think this is a useless process at all. I think it's useful to hear what the governor has proposed and discuss the relative merits and then offer some of our own ideas, too. I think we need to spend some time doing that.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Gottwald, you know, that's fine. It's a good exercise, as long as we realize that it's not a real budget. That's the thing. You know, and as far as coming up with solutions, I mean, we have some partial solutions at least, which is to raise some revenue, and that solution is completely rejected and apparently off the table. So, you know, I just wish that the governor, when he makes this budget proposal, would actually, since his rhetoric is that we can solve the problem just with cuts, and he is tasked with coming forward to show how that might be done, and he has control of the agencies that put together these books and show us where it could be done, I think it would be very nice if he would actually put forward a proposal that would actually show how he thinks it could be done. And I, you know, we'll just continue on, and I won't say any more about it for now. But, you know, just as long as we understand that he hasn't done that. His proposal has not really been put forward, because this is not real money. He's counting on something that's basically a hope and a prayer. And he's not even hoping and praying for it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, I just can't let that go by without comment. This sort of reminds me of deja vu all over again, because this is exactly how we felt last year when the leadership put forward $34 billion in spending and then assumed we were going to get the rest of it with tax money, even though the governor said very plainly that wasn't going to happen. So you were working on false hopes then, and you may not like the way the governor is putting this together. He has put something together, just as he did last year at the end of January, We had several months to work on it, and at the end of the day, we didn't put together a realistic budget. We didn't pass a realistic budget, and now it's our job. We've got some suggestions from the governor. It's not his job to do the legislature's job. So I think instead of, you know, pointing the finger at the governor's office, I think it's time that we get to work and we come up with our own solutions instead of, I just got a little tired of last year, 3 months, bashing the governor. Well, where's our ideas? If you have different ideas, then let's have them.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. And first of all, Ms. Rankin, thank you and thank Mr. Hoffman for this. I think that exactly what I wanted. So next we have Dr. Sulik.
Good afternoon. Well,
lucky he's a professional.
Let me just interrupt there for a minute. You know, we may or may not get that $385. What we're seeing here is the governor's is the $340 million that the governor has wants in cuts. If that $385 does happen to come here, none of it really has to go to the human services budget. Okay, and however, we will have if that were to happen and none of it came here, then we would have to make some other cuts because there's a maintenance of effort for. A minimum of things in this budget. So I think we can go ahead and look at what the governor is proposing, and but remember when that $385 comes, it will change things, but we can't be under the assumption that all $385 is coming to human services. I'd be very surprised if that happened. Dr. Sulik.
Thank you. Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner for the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration for the Department of Human Services. Last time I was here, I think the Minnesota Nurses Association was here, so it's nice to see you all again. I want to start with just a couple of background statements that I think are really important. First of all, the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration is the administration that is truly charged to serve individuals with mental illness and with addictions in the state of Minnesota. And we take that very, very seriously and very, very passionately. I just want to publicly thank the staff that have been asked to do some very painful work and try to come up with some proposals that we do believe are as painless in this grand scheme of things that we possibly can. I can't even begin to tell you the countless numbers of hours that my staff have combed through not only what I will present to you, but what we're not presenting to you. So what I will tell you is that what's not presented here is the result of a tremendous amount of work. And not just by me, but by, a large number of employees that work for us. The second point is there's multiple interactions with what you will hear over the next several days from this budget. I won't try to speak to those today because I really think that you need to be able to hear the entire budget from all the areas across the department. And if you have specific questions about how does that come back and affect or not affect individuals with mental illness or addictions, then we'll be prepared to answer those questions for you. But know that we have been watching this and have been incredibly hypervigilant about that aspect and trying to really be thoughtful about the impact back on the people that we serve. The last point is you may be very interested in what is coming forward regarding state-operated services specifically because there's been lots of changes being asked to be done with state-operated services. As you all know, we are preparing the final stages of developing a plan and a report to report back to you all about some proposed changes in a redesign of state-operated services that will improve efficiency, that will improve quality at the same time. People say that that's impossible to do, but I think that we've gotten so much work and effort into this that I'll be able to come forward in a couple weeks and demonstrate that hopefully we can do just that, as well as achieve some new partnerships in that redesign. So the budgetary page specific to state-operated services that I will present will not give you some details, because we really felt like the ask that we were given specific to state operated services, we really felt we could not do that in isolation from this broader redesign effort. And so I left a meeting today that the final stages of that thinking is being done. So we will be back with more specific information in regards to that. So if there are not specific background questions, I'll just move you to the first page.
Chair?
Yeah. Representatives.
Is any specific date that we can be expecting that?
We're actually, our goal is to have that report finalized by the end of next week. Okay. So it's live and coming forward in a very rapid pace. I hope to be making some individual meetings with several of you prior to the public release of the report so that you have some preparation on it. I think we are the second or third page in your book. As Jane Rankin pointed out, the pages renumber. So I think it's the third blue page is the page I'll ask you to turn to. And then the first budgetary, is it the second blue page? Okay. Then the first page that I'll present is specific to the adult mental health budget reduction. And now again, this is the proposal, these are the governor's proposals to reduce the budget expenditures for this biennium in order to balance the budget. So you may have questions specific to how does this pertain to the redesign and transformation we're attempting to occur. These specific changes are where we believe that there could be some potential savings. The first item on this page that I'll turn your attention to is that we are proposing to delay the implementation of additional crisis intervention team training for law enforcement. This is merely a one-time reduction of $200,000 for the fiscal year 2010. We essentially would propose that we just would not implement that training during the remainder of this year. Funding will resume in 2011. That is crisis intervention training specific to law enforcement to help them intervene with individuals with a mental illness that might be in a mental health crisis. It is important training. This is merely a proposal to delay that in order to come up with that $200,000 of savings. The second item is proposed to eliminate the implementation of additional housing with support services, which would have been funded by reallocating underspending from the calendar year 2009. The plan would have been that the leftover money that was not spent in calendar year 2009 would have been allocated into additional housing with support services. This is a total of $3.3 million. It's a significant dollar amount. Rather than reallocating that at this time, we're proposing that that money would be used to contribute to the savings necessary. The third item is the plan is to eliminate the specialty care grants that were part of the 2007 Mental Health Initiative infrastructure investments. But these were grants, you will hear me also present this item on the Children's Mental Health budgetary page as well. These were items that have, it's a $200,000 amount. It was designated more or less for special projects, special initiatives. It has just not gotten started, and we essentially are proposing that would be an area where in this current time it's not the time to start new initiatives or new projects. That's a $200,000 amount for the adult mental health area and also the children's mental health area, and we're suggesting that those would be a permanent removal. So that savings would continue, would begin fiscal year 2010, continue in 11, and continue on thereafter. The fourth item is proposed to reduce the medical assistance adult day treatment authorization threshold. Currently from 115 hours a day treatment services per calendar year to $60 per calendar year. I'm sorry, 60 hours per calendar year. This equates to about a $500,000 per year savings by placing a cap on the total number of hours per individual per year. If you look at the entire array of services that we want to prioritize and need to prioritize, this is not an elimination of day treatment services, but just a reduction on the total number of hours that would be approved.
Dr. Sulik,
yes?
Have you accounted for the fact that this may result in some of these people showing up in other budget items?
Mr. Chair, the analysis that I'm aware of that was done regarding that particular budget item is that it was not estimated that we would see much change over and above We would not expect to see additional costs in other areas. And that is at least from the preliminary analysis that was done by our staff. The last item on this page is proposed to reduce the dedicated compulsive problem the compulsive and problem gambling state funds by a total of $229,000 in fiscal year 2010 and $106,000 in fiscal year 2011. How that breaks down is that this is money that is unspent at this time or not granted out at this time, and there would just that money that has not been allocated out or is not being spent or has been spent as of yet would be used for savings. That would not carry on after this biennium, so that would just be looking at the forecast of spending of expenditures as of to date and just removing that leftover money from that fund.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is 60 hours per calendar year translated to in terms of what's a day?
A day treatment could range from 3 hours to 5 hours, I believe. So essentially, most people that are in day treatment are in day treatment for a couple of weeks. It still gives several weeks of services.
12 to 20 days range going, okay.
Yes.
All right.
I believe that the actual treatment component of day treatment is specified as 3 hours per day.
Thanks.
Other questions?
Continue. No. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll ask you to turn to the second page, which are the budgetary changes proposed for the Chemical Dependency Fund. The first item proposes to transfer the available balance in the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund to the General Fund as a result of lower than expected expenditures in the fiscal year 2009. Again, just a reminder, that's a forecasted amount each year. There was essentially $4.8 million from fiscal year 2009 that was not spent by treatment services. That money, rather than being reinvested at this time, is being proposed to be used to contribute to these savings.
And again, that's a one-time.
Exactly. The second item is proposed to reduce ongoing consolidated chemical dependency treatment fund expenditures by 5% annually in fiscal year 2011, 2012, and 2013. This would be accomplished by lowering the rates paid to treatment providers by 5%. Now, there is, as you all know, there in the last session, there was a specific call for us to reform the rate of the way of reimbursements and to achieve rate reform regarding our chemical dependency treatment rates. That process is going live now and has been ongoing since the last session. That is expected that at the beginning of fiscal year 2011 there will be a completely new rate reform and new way of arriving at state determined rates paid for various treatment different types of treatment services that would be paid out of the Consolidated Treatment Fund. That legislation that passed last year does give about a 3.5% increase in allocation. So the total loss to the Consolidated Treatment Fund from this proposal here would be about a 1.5% after fiscal year 2010. Just wanted to point that out.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Sulik. Especially your opening comments, I would have to agree with you 100%. I appreciate your work and the department's work. But just a few questions. Right now, who is served under the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund?
Individuals in the state of Minnesota that are at 100% of poverty or lower are eligible if they've met eligibility requirements based on finances and then also based on the Rule 25 assessment. The Rule 25 assessment is that standardized assessment that is done to determine eligibility or need for inpatient or outpatient chemical dependency treatment.
Sure. Representative Hodge.
Dr. Sulik, also within your budget document here, you said that it could result in providers closing their door with the 5% rate cut. Do you have an idea how many providers might have to close their door?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, in regards to that question, if you remember even from last year when I presented the proposed changes to the Consolidated Treatment Fund, our rates of reimbursement for a large number of providers are lower than their costs or barely allowing them to meet their costs, and we're aware of that, which is one of the reasons we were calling for rate reform. We expect that there are providers that would find this very difficult to sustain their services based on a significant reduction of 5% in the rates paid by the state. How many of those providers there are that would be impacted, I honestly don't know the exact number. We project that there are some. There's some initial analysis that we did about what could this mean for total number of individuals impacted. What we know is that we expect some providers certainly to feel a significant burden from this reduction, and there may be some providers that are not able to sustain continue to be viable with this reduction.
Mr. Chair.
Rip. Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sulik, with the GAMC situation that we're in, which is for adults under 75% of poverty, which we know are disproportionately overrepresented by individuals with chemical dependencies, and with this 5% reduction for that very same group of people, essentially, and the acknowledgement that providers may go out of business. On top of losing health care, which under the auto-enrollment scenario that we're in could be 17,000 people after 6 months, and with the closing of doors of chemical dependency providers, what does this population of people, what's their next option to go to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, I think that we are certainly needing to think and have been thinking about the full impact of potential reductions in our various health care plans in the state of Minnesota and the potential impact back on, will this mean an increase in commitments? Will this mean an increase in commitments to state facilities as a result? To be honest with you, we have some ideas of some forecasts in that regard. I think it's going to be, you know, there's a lot up in the air right now as to see what's going to truly happen regarding all of the proposals that are before you. I expect that if, in fact, that this reduction of 5% for the fiscal year 2010 going into rate reform for fiscal year 2011, I'm hopeful that most of our providers will be able to stay in business with us and manage through this with us so that we don't impair access to care. We have capacity in the state system. However, our state system, just to remind you, is not appropriated. So our state facilities serving individuals with chemical dependency are impacted just as significantly as our other community providers in this regard. So that is a precarious situation we're well aware of at this time.
Dr. Sulik, just to show my ignorance again, maybe this is too detailed, but the San Marco apartments in Duluth, better known as the Wet House, practically all these people are on GAMC. Do they get chemical dependency treatment? Is that part of their GAMC, or is the chemical dependency treatment completely separate from that?
Mr. Chair, the chemical dependency treatment for either inpatient or outpatient is paid directly out of the Consolidated Treatment Fund.
Okay, thank you. And now Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification. The book says reduce these expenditures by 5%, and you're talking about rate cuts, but then you also have stuff in here about a reduction in patients served, and that's 1,500 fewer Minnesotans will receive these services heretofore entitled benefit for all who are eligible. So it's confusing. Are you actually proposing rate cuts, or are you proposing we serve less people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we're proposing on this page rate cuts. We attempted to convert that to if we forecasted out a full impact. And as you know, I try to present to you the big picture and the full picture of impact and benefits from anything we would propose. If we translate impact to potential, not guaranteed, but potential reduction in treatment availability, that there's a reduction in capacity as a result, then there would be an estimate of a number of people that could go potentially without treatment.
But these are rate cuts.
This is based completely on rate cuts. It would not be a reduction in eligibility. So an example of reduction in eligibility would be that if you're at 75% of poverty instead of 100, we attempted not to do that.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. Representative Thiessen took half my question, so we're thinking alike here. I was puzzled. Is this county administered, or is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it's county administered services. So the Rule 25 assessment and the eligibility for your the eligibility is determined by county in order for you to draw out of the Consolidated Treatment Fund.
And Mr. Mayor, I'll talk to Dr. Sluk later about this, but I had the privilege of being on the county redesign council that we passed last year, and they're working on some of these very topics. And so if this becomes law, I hope the language is flexible enough so that they can shift amongst counties and spend the same amount of money and spend it maybe better. So it's kind of part of the redesign. So I'm trying to be the optimist here on all this. So thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Dr. Sulik, by the way, we miss you up in St. Cloud.
Yeah.
You did a great job up there. One of the ideas that we're at least working with here in the legislature this session is something that may, in fact, drive commercial rates. And you talk about rate reform, it would be significant rate reform. What would commercial rates do to this picture?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, essentially, the consolidated treatment, most of the individuals that I draw out of the consolidated treatment fund at this time are not on commercial plans. However, what you may not understand is that many of our commercial plans in the state of Minnesota have lowered their rates of reimbursement to match what is paid out of the consolidated treatment fund. And most times, most of us in the healthcare systems, and I'll speak just from my experience, we've been able to make up for a significant lower rate of reimbursement perhaps out of Medicaid because our commercial plans paid much higher. So I just want to, I think it's an important point that you all are very much aware of, that many of our commercial plans match what the consolidated treatment funds pay. I don't know, I don't have the exact numbers. If you're interested, we will certainly get that to you.
Representative Bunn.
Just a follow-up question on that, Dr. Sulik. Just previously you stated that we currently may be paying under cost for this treatment with the pre-reform rate that the state's been paying. And you're now saying that the private plans have been meeting the low state reimbursement rate here. And so I'm not quite sure how there's currently operating viable business models if this is their only area. Are they working across a number of areas which are getting higher reimbursements and therefore they're doing some shifting across?
Mr. Chair and Representative, going back last year to the legislation that we proposed regarding the rate reform, we found an enormous variability in rates paid. The practice in Minnesota to date has been that if you were a chemical dependency treatment provider, you had to have what's called a host county contract. Mm-hmm. And your rate of payment was determined between you and that host county. Mm-hmm. And then that's what you got paid. Mm-hmm. But so we had 87 different negotiators out mm-hmm. there, essentially, which is why there's such a huge variability in the rates paid and in then does that match their costs. So there are some providers that got paid well above the mean and some providers being paid well below the mean. What we did last year in order to achieve some immediate savings necessary to balance the budget in this last session was we capped the rate of reimbursement at 165% of the mean. Maybe it was 160%. Somebody could correct me now. I'm not remembering. And then that was done until the rate reform could go into effect. The savings from that is projected likely to continue total from the Consolidated Treatment Fund, because if we keep looking at every year, there's some amount of money left over in the forecast from the Consolidated Treatment Fund. I believe, honestly, that the rate reform will help solve a tremendous amount of that. I believe that there's commercial rate reform that can occur so that there's a different type of payment from the commercial plans that will help our providers significantly. I'm sure in public testimony you're likely to hear from some providers who will tell you their financial pressures that they're experiencing, and some of them will find it difficult to get 5% less from us.
Okay, Members, we've already used up an hour, and so let's keep the questions brief. Dr. Sulik.
Mr. Chair, the last item on this page that I'll just bring your attention to is to essentially use the remaining money left in an unspent fund from an American Indian grant. This totals $389,000 total. This is just a grant that was, it was a legislatively allocated grant. They've just not utilized, they've not used all the spending, all the money available to them, and therefore we're just proposing as a one-time reduction to take that leftover money. Moving forward to the next page, this would be page 4. I'll present to you the proposed reductions in the children's mental health area. First item here is proposed to eliminate the child mental health specialty care grant. This is the exact same grant that I presented in the adult mental health pages. It's a $200,000 annual amount allocated out of the 2007 Governor's Mental Health Initiative that was passed. This is sort of designated a special project, special initiatives. We're proposing to just not start those and to take that $200,000 as ongoing savings. The second item would be to reduce child mental health case management grants. These are grants paid from the Children's Mental Health Division out to counties. This would total $1,210,000. Again, that's a dollar amount that is spread over 87 counties. Certainly, we recognize that's not without impact in some areas. The total dollar amount impact by county, I don't have in front of me. If there's specific interest based on individual counties that you would want to know information on, we can present to you what that cost would be.
And Dr. Sulik, do you just have an estimate of what percentage of that grant funds, that 1.2, is?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn around because we were asked that at the Senate. Now I don't remember what the answer was. Do you, John? What? Mr. Chair, is about half the total that they receive.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sulik, how does this interact with the grants that the counties get that are part of our discussion about the GAMC bill that was vetoed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't believe that the GAMC bill had children's mental health grants considered. I believe that the grants that were proposed to be reduced were stripped completely out of the adult mental health grant money. So this is a part of the children's mental health grant dollars given to counties, a long line of multiple different grants that go out to counties, including for school-based services, et cetera.
I think we also hit child protection grants to counties.
Okay.
Not child mental health.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I'm confusing the two things, but while I have the floor, just another quick question. What we're seeing here, how does this just pick up where the unallotments leave off and then cut more, or are the unallotments in here as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the proposals here that I'm presenting to you are over and above anything that you've received previously. So this is on top of any previous unallotments.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last item on this page, this is an area we presented last year as well, and that is a proposal to delay the Youth Act program. ACT is assertive community treatment. This is essentially a mobile, intensive psychiatric and social services and psychological treatment services serving individuals with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, other very significant serious mental illness. It's an incredibly successful model for adults. We have numerous ACT teams across the state. We definitely want to initiate ACT teams for youth. It's an area of need that I think we will see benefit from. This is merely a delay proposal. We've already delayed this proposal already, but because this is a program that tiers up in its expenditure over 3 years, by delaying for 1 year, we get significant accrual of savings, and that's what's being presented here. So the program would be delayed until, let's see, November 1st of 2011. By doing that, we achieve $513,000 in savings in fiscal year 2011. Yet, in fiscal year 2012, there's $1,161,000 in savings, and in fiscal year 2013, $1,185,000 in savings. And again, those savings are just because it's been delayed by that additional amount of time.
But Dr. Stilick, and when we had the debate over the new mental health hospital, basically for children, some of the comments were that that they'd be better suited by day treatment kinds of facilities. And how do these series of grants affect that?
Mr. Chair, I think that we're always looking for non-hospital-based ways of providing community-based services for individuals with mental health needs. And ACT is an example of a very successful community-based service that is shown in adults to definitely decrease hospitalization and decrease the costs associated with hospitalization. So by no means is this a recommendation that it's not warranted that we continue to pursue this. We'll see the value of this when we're able to implement it, clearly.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, just a quick, so is that supposed to be implemented this year for the first time, or has it been delayed already?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, cool. It's already been delayed from when it was supposed to be implemented, and this is an additional delay being presented here.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sulik, is there a federal component to this? Is there a federal match to youth ACT model?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, yes. ACT is MA eligible service. So if the children are on fee-for-service MA, there's a federal match for this service.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
So that means that each time we delay it, we are unable to pull the federal match in because they won't be receiving the services because you haven't implemented that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, yes. Each time we delay, we're delaying the whatever component of federal match dollars we'd be getting from that dollar amount.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden, right now that would be 62%. Dr. Sulik.
Next page is page 5. This is specific to a proposal here to capture a balance that is remaining in what is now an obsolete state-operated services account. The governor recommends capturing the balance in the obsolete laundry depreciation account and taking that as savings in fiscal year 2010. This is an account that is left over from when, at a time, we had all the regional treatment centers had their own laundry services. There had to be an account that protected funds in order to replace laundry equipment. We only have one facility continuing to use its own laundry facilities, and that is the St. Peter campus. There is right now, all the other services have been contracted out to Corrections, another state agency, but is able to provide the service at a much reduced cost to us trying to provide it ourselves. The proposal here is that there would not be any depreciation dollars necessary for that remaining St. Peter campus laundry facility because we're in negotiations with the Department of Corrections to provide that service finally for the St. Peter campus as well. That's a value of $669,000. Last page in the area that I'll present is page 6, and this is specific to a reduction in the total state-operated services appreciation. What is proposed here is that there would be a 0.75% reduction in the state-operated services operations, and in order to achieve that, it is proposed and estimated that there would have to be we would have to get smaller. This is a 0.75% reduction over and above all the current financial pressures that are on state operated services as a result of the legislative changes last year, as a result of unallotment, as a result of additional budgetary pressures. All of those budgetary pressures are being handled through this state operated services redesign process. This dollar amount has been added into that process, and therefore I can't tell you today that there's an estimate that this particular facility would be transformed or closed and what the degree of total impact on staff or not impact on staff might be until we complete the proposal on how all of the potential now $15 to $17 million total of expenditures or savings necessary for state operated services would be handled.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sulik, I'm looking here at the budget page from last year with the GAMC restructuring or elimination or however you want to call it, and it shows that there'd be an impact of state operated services of $9 million this biennium and $13 million next biennium. Have you figured that into your calculations?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh, we have been very closely watching the forecasts from what will happen to the GAMC individuals and what percentage of GAMC clients may wind up required services back through state-operated services. As we go through these potential budgetary changes, we are being forced to be completely mindful to expected increase in utilization and how we would accommodate that increase in utilization.
Representative Hosh.
Dr. Sulik, do you know what the average cost is per participant in state-operated services is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, that's a difficult question because there's so many different types of services being provided. But I'll talk specifically about the community behavioral health hospitals, for instance. On average, those hospitals have had a fixed cost because there are 16-bed facilities and they've been staffed in such a way that there's been a fixed pattern of cost to them. So the cost per case reduces if the census in the facilities is maximized. Right now, there's an average cost per day of about $1,000 and some for hospitalization there. The average total cost per treatment episode on average is about anywhere from $16,000 to $20,000, depending on the average length of stay in the facility.
Thank you. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, that's it for my section.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Sulik, and we appreciate your openness.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to start, Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. I'd like to actually start with a page that you have, separate sheet that looks like this. This is a counterpart.
Can you state your name and title for the tape?
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. This sheet accompanies the one that Ms. Rankin showed you for the MA part of our budget. This shows the growth rate in the programs related to Children and Family Services part of the department. I won't go through this in detail, but I'll just point out a little bit of the stories behind some of the numbers that are here. If you look at the upper left, that is the MFIP cash forecast. Shows again 4 years of actual and 2 years of forecast. You can see there are two distinct different patterns. The first 3 years, the cost actually going down and the cost going up in 9, 10, and 11. That's really the recession effect, caseload effect in MFIP, and more families using the program because of the economy. Actually, the long-term trend of the program has been down generally. We saw it go up after the 01, 02 recession as well, but then it went back down after the economy started to grow. The two other charts on the top both represent the food, the MFIP food, and then the other food support. This is 100% federal money, so it doesn't relate directly to the budget discussion here. But there are two factors there. One is the federal stimulus, which added 13.6% onto all food stamp benefits, playing out, as you can see, in 9 and 10, but also very rapid growth in the food support program. We've had 100,000 people added to the program just in the last year. We're over 400,000 people for the first time ever in Minnesota. That's just been a very rapidly growing service here. On the bottom part of the chart are adults.
And just if you could hold off there, on the MFIP food, so that big 23% increase is due to extra funding from stimulus, and then I assume in 2011 that stimulus money goes away, and that's the reason there's a big drop there?
Mr. Chair, that's our understanding as well. There's big stimulus input in terms of the increase in the actual benefits. There's also some of that increase is just driven by the caseload increase in MFIP itself.
I was hoping that Mr. Hoffman had predicted a recovery of our economy, but apparently that's I can't say that.
Not quite yet, Mr. Chair, I don't think. On the bottom part of the table are the three programs in my area that serve adult populations, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, General Assistance, and Group Residential Housing. The MSA program has been essentially flat. There's a small decrease that actually, there's a small unallotment that affected MSA that probably is playing in part in why you see a reduction in the last couple of years there. On the general assistance program, you see the same pattern. We actually put in another without the unallotment to show you what the annual average growth would have been higher if the unallotment had not happened. That was the unallotment of the emergency general assistance program, which was about $8 million a year that affected 10 and 11. You can see if you look back to the earlier years, pretty steady growth in general assistance. That's entirely caseload driven. The program has really grown quite steadily since the beginning of this decade through till today. And in group residential housing, that has been quite a rapidly growing program. You can see the average of 8.7% over the time period here. I don't have a clear picture of why 11 drops. We did make some reductions last year to pieces of funding within GRH, the personal needs allowance, community living supplement, but I'm not sure what else is at work as to why that's dropping. That would be a Mr. Hoffman question.
Thank you, and again, thank you for these this sheet, the one that Jane Rankin showed us. Representative Abler.
Thanks, and I appreciate the sheets, too.
I know, but
it'd be helpful to me if this doesn't include the governor's proposed budget. Is that right, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson? Is that correct?
That's correct.
It would be interesting for me to see what the net would be if there was a proposed gray line or something under these sheets. You'll be here all week, so if it could come back tomorrow or Thursday. It would be just to get the big picture for us, and we could kind of see what's left.
Mr. Representative Abel, I'm sure we could do that.
Thank you. For both sheets.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my part of the governor's budget proposal start immediately after. Just go past the blue sheet after Dr. Sulik's part, and you come to the Children and Family Services part. Again, it's pagination is page one because we start over with each section. The first proposal in this section is to eliminate the general assistance program. General assistance is a cash assistance program that serves 19,000 low-income Minnesotans. It serves single individuals and childless couples. There are 15 eligibility categories. Most of the people in GA are temporarily ill or disabled or otherwise experiencing some reason why they can't work. About a quarter are in residential facilities, mostly in GRH facilities. This is a 100% state general funded program. This proposal would do three things. First, it eliminates the basic GA program for about 14,600 recipients. These are individuals who are not in residential facilities, but rather are living out in the community. Most of these are the folks who are getting benefits based on the $203 monthly standard that we have in the general assistance program. Secondly, it creates a short-term assistance program for this population. That would be about $11 million a year when it is fully implemented. This would be a program that people could access for short-term needs. Anyone who fits this category, that's a single individual or childless couple under 200% of poverty, be administered through the counties. Thirdly, this proposal retains the personal needs allowance that is paid through the general assistance program to individuals who live in residential facilities. This is an $89 personal assistance program to individuals who live in residential facilities. This is an $89 personal needs allowance that goes to individuals who are in residential facilities. Again, most of those are group residential housing facilities. There are 4,400 of those individuals in the program today. We're proposing that this would be effective in December of 2010. There are two offsets in the budget you'll notice. One is the loss of recoveries under GA, which are fairly significant. The recoveries we get under the GA program now largely when we transition people to SSI. And then also there's an estimate of a GRH impact. That is that some of the people who lose GA eligibility will end up in group residential housing, and that's also accounted for in our fiscal estimate.
So, Mr. Johnson, the I'm just trying to line up my. So we would lose 2011. We would have put some of those people into SSI, and they would have paid us back for what we had spent. Is that the 585?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, you said most of the people on GA have had a loss of job because of an injury or disability. Part of the governor's plan for the auto enrollment also into Minnesota Care has a $1,000 deductible. And most of these people will be losing $203 a month, which is probably their only income, which is, what, about $2,400 a year. How are they supposed to pay when they're losing essentially everything in these circumstances and do not have the ability to work because of a disability?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh, that is definitely a challenge with this proposal. We are counting on counties and others in the community to help and provide assistance to those individuals, but certainly the loss of this money is not going to be helpful in terms of their ability to manage that situation.
Mr. Johnson, if this were to pass, a person who was auto-enrolled on Minnesota Care and had a $1,000 deductible, do you think they'd be able to pay that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh, I don't know. It would depend on the person's circumstances, what other supports or help they had in place. I would think many of these people, even with the 203, wouldn't be able to pay it because the 203 is being used for other purposes now. So I'm not sure how many would see a changed situation versus how many are going to struggle under either scenario.
Representative Hosh.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. It's I understand that the commissioner in the Senate hearing said that these individuals need to have greater ingenuity to deal with these cuts. And we're really requiring these people to have a lot of ingenuity with the GAMC, auto enrollment, the reduction of GA, the chemical dependency grants that might result in a reduction of providers. And I think we need to talk about what, you know, this is a snowball effect on this very population over and over and over again. Every page we turn here seems to be falling on the same category or the same population of individuals.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I know you're not, it's not a good day for you. The interactions of all this continues to impress me. I've had my 12th session to be on this committee, and the interactions still confound me. I just have a question about group residential housing. You said that might go up. Is that an entitlement with a forecast, or is there an amount of money we appropriate for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, it is an entitlement with a forecast, although there are limits on new beds within the GA category for that program.
And just, I know we can't look at every program in depth, but what's the general eligibility standards for GRH?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, you either have to be SSI eligible or GA eligible, and I can't give you the precise dollar numbers that go with that off the top of my head, but I could get that for you.
That's fine. Thank you. I don't need help.
Well, Mr. Johnson, first, this page and the next two relate to SSI. Has the department, and I don't know if this is your area, if it isn't, forget it, but they were, we gave you money to hire 16 people, I believe, to help move people into SSI. Has that been started yet?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's in the SMRT area in healthcare. That would not be my area. We do have work within my area, where we work with interim assistance agreements for people on GA, people in MFIP, people in a variety of public programs, largely through contracts with individuals and organizations in the community to help people move from GA, from MFIP to SSI. So we have similar work going on, and in fact, we want to coordinate with the SMRT people on that. But I think we get 16 positions, I know that, so you must be talking about another part of the department.
Well, I had somebody in my office today, and he said it took him 2.5 years to get on SSI.
Mr. Chair, that's not unusual.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, like minds think alike, I was going to ask the exact same question. So, thank you.
Great minds think alike. Mr. Johnson, and we're going to finish up here in about 3 minutes.
Mr. Chair, the second page, page 2 in your book, relates to a change to the MSA program. This is Minnesota Supplemental Aid. MSA is a cash assistance program. It's a supplement to people who are receiving SSI in Minnesota. The program pays a basic grant to individuals. It's around $90, so it depends on individual circumstances. The program has also had special needs within the program, which essentially means if an individual has a special need, they can come to the county, make a request, and if it falls within one of the categories in law, we can provide funding for those special needs. This proposal would eliminate the special needs funding. This is a special needs funding for home repairs, household furniture, representative pays, a number of other services that are listed in the third paragraph on the budget page. It's also connected to an allotment the governor made this summer. That was the unallotment of the special diet money within MSA. Same sort of service, but that was for special diets as opposed to these special needs. Together, those account for about 4,400 individuals that would be impacted by this change.
Okay, so Mr. Johnson, this would basically put into law what the unallotment did. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? This does not cover the unallotment. This only covers the other special needs that were not covered in the unallotment. The special diets, which were covered in the unallotment, is part of the governor's unallotment ratification request, which is separate from this budget page.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, page 3. Page 3 addresses the Minnesota Family Investment Program and the Child Care Assistance Program. This deals with how we treat income in determining eligibility and in determining benefits for individuals, particularly how we count disability income through SSI and MSA. Currently within MFIP and Child Care, we don't count SSI income to determine eligibility and to determine benefits. That is, we essentially exclude that income when we're looking at a family's overall income. The Child Care Assistance Program does count MSA, but MFIP does not count MSA. You'll recall that between 2004 and 2008, we did count a portion of SSI toward the MFIP grant. That was repealed a couple of years ago. What this proposal does for the MFIP program is essentially to count all the SSI and MSA in a household when determining eligibility and in determining the benefits for the family. We essentially would add the individual in as a mandatory unit member into the MFIP family, which means their needs would be counted, but so would all of their income. For the Child Care Assistance Program, we propose to count SSI in determining child care benefits. For MFIP, this is proposed to be effective November 1st of 2010, and for child care, March 1st of 2011. This would align us with how we count other unearned income in the program, particularly RSDI, which is Social Security Disability Income. We now have always counted that dollar for dollar. This would count SSI and MSA in the same way, dollar for dollar as unearned income. It also aligns across programs. We'd have all programs counting income the same, aligning with the food stamp program. The impact of this in MFIP, 500 families would lose assistance. Another 4,000 families would move from MFIP cash and food to become food-only families. In child care assistance, which is not in this committee, the impact is really on co-pays. Families would have higher co-pays. The savings are reflected on the budget page in 2011, $21 million in TANF savings for MFIP, $116,000 in general fund savings in the child care program. The TANF savings are refinanced on a later budget page that I'll talk about.
Okay. And wasn't there stimulus money in TANF?
Mr. Chair, there is stimulus money in TANF, and we have another proposal related to that I'll get to. There was no maintenance of effort around the stimulus money in TANF.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. And with that, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Our time has run out, and the meeting is adjourned.